Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.
This is Dante Lee, and you should check out Z, the SEO Queen.
This is David Spradley, and you should check out Z, the SEO Queen.
Do you have an online business or want an online business but lack the team or the expertise to get on Google page one? Did you know that 33% of all Google search traffic clicks the first result only? Do you want to get more traffic to your website, social media profile, or just want your video to get more hits or go viral? Well, you need to contact the SEO Queen Digital Marketing Agency, where you are more than just a number. You can't lose with the SEO Queen. More visibility, more credibility, more profitability. Visit theseoqueen.net for more information. That's theseoqueen.net. theseoqueen.net. That's theseoqueen.net.
This is David Spradley, and you should check out Z, the SEO Queen.
The SEO Queen, the SEO Queen, more credibility. The SEO Queen, more visibility. The SEO Queen, more profitability. The SEO Queen, 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 more credibility, more visibility, more profitability. The SEO Queen.
Hello, welcome to the SEO Queen Tech Show, a podcast to help you get more credibility, visibility, and profitability through inspiration, technology, and marketing insight. This podcast is for professionals and entrepreneurs who are looking to get more customers, clients, and patients. We are broadcast worldwide on Bashani Radio, iHeartRadio, and iTunes. Bashani Radio, always talking about everything from New York City. You can listen to the SEO Queen Tech Show on any mobile phone or tablet device. Also, as a thank you gift for listening to the SEO Queen Tech Show, you can go to SEOQueen.com and download the free ebook, 101 Ways to Improve Your Marketing and Sales. In addition, you could always go to SEOQueen.com/conference and learn more information about how you can boost your company's visibility through the Reach More Clients Conference that's happening July 29th, 30th, and 31st. So I am so excited to have today's guest with me. She is Dr. Karen Getney. She is an internal medicine specialist who spent almost 30 years behind bars as a prison physician. She was designated as one of the best in the business by the American Correctional Association and won a Heroes for Humanity Award for her work in HIV in the correctional system. Her true stories in the book that she authored, it's called 30 Years Behind Bars, Trials of a Prison Doctor, which is available on Amazon, documents her the true stories of a young, naive physician who survived a world she was ill-prepared for and turned it into a calling. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to some and present to others none other than today's guest, Dr. Karen Getney. How are you today?
I'm wonderful, Z, and I really appreciate you having me on your podcast today.
Well, I appreciate you coming on to my podcast today because you have a story that when I met you, I knew my listeners had to hear.
Well, I really appreciate that. And I have to say that it's my experience that very few people have met prison doctors, especially female ones who've done 3 decades in prison and survived and then want to turn it into a calling when they leave.
Right. Absolutely. So let's start from the very beginning. What drew you to medicine? What made you interested in biology and medicine? What drew you to that?
Yeah, that's sort of interesting. I look back at my childhood and you would never expect it because I grew up in upstate New York in the Catskill Mountains, sort of in boonie land. Neither one of my parents ever finished high school because of the Second World War. My mother was an immigrant. And for some reason, and I think it was because I was highly nearsighted, the only thing I could see was like close a book, and I loved books. And it was really books. I would read stories about individuals who, let's say, fought against abuses of power. And I especially liked series about doctors who worked at different times in history, pushing all the, let's say, things that no one else would do. And somehow in my mind, at literally 9 years old, I decided I'm going to be a doctor. I had no idea what that was because I hadn't even been to a doctor. But the romance and the intrigue and the danger and fighting for causes, I don't know, just clicked in my brain. And my parents told me, oh, we knew you were going to be a doctor. I said, why? They said, you were already sticking your stuffed animals with needles, you know, in their arms for injections and things like that. And I, for some reason, I always wanted to be a doctor. And I actually was terrified of ever being in a hospital. Then I had to do everything on scholarships because my parents, they had that German mindset. Well, that's nice. You want to be educated, but we have no idea how to do that. So at 18, you're on your own. So I did everything on my own. I got the scholarships. I worked all the time. And it was a real blessing that I got a major scholarship, the National Health Service Corps scholarship that financed medical school.
Oh, wow.
And that was a complete ride in those days. And what happened is they paid for your tuition, and then they gave you a bit of a stipend for books, supplies, and a teeny bit to live on. Mm-hmm. And so I was probably one of the few doctors who left without debt. You see what I mean?
Mm.
Because I had all these scholarships, and also I hardly ever ate and did nothing. You know what I mean? Except work all the time.
Right, right.
And in return, after your internal medicine residency.
Wait, I have a question. You went through college and you said you hardly ever ate?
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I was eating. You know, that's one of those days in the college where I worked in the snack bar.
Oh, okay.
You see what I mean?
Right, sort of
their manager. And of course, if they were going to throw away food, I was like, okay, I got to take some of that little food because it's going to be thrown away anyway. So right. I had minimal eating in those years, which I don't know has benefited me because I'm still slender, you know, in my old age now, in my 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah, and
I caught that freshman 15.
Yeah. So, but
working on losing it.
Yeah. Fortunately, I don't have that problem. But imagine after my residency, the government says, okay, you owe 4 years payback. This is how it works. They give you the scholarship. You work 4 years in a place mm-hmm. no one else would work. And I assumed that I would be put in an inner city or rural area. In fact, I even interviewed at Cabrini Green in Chicago back in the day.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when I got flown out there, I went to one clinic and then I walked to the other clinic through the war zone. I think they all thought I was crazy, you know? And when I ended up at the other clinic, they were like, oh my God, how did you get here? I said, I walked from there to there. Like I walked all that way through Cabrini Green. And they said, what are you, crazy? A woman like you was just murdered there, you know, yesterday. I was like, I had no idea. This is how naive I was. But when I finished interviewing Cabrini Green and went back to Nevada, where I was doing my finishing my residency, they mm-hmm. said, we have a spot in Nevada. I was like, really? And they said, yes, we're going to put you in prison. I was like, okay. Now I go from Cabrini into a male security prison in Nevada. And they couldn't get doctors in those days. This is back in the 80s,
mm-hmm.
1987, because it was just dangerous. They paid basically nothing. And it was, you know, you're working in really horrendous conditions in those days.
Did you have enough medical supplies, or even that was a problem?
Well, yeah, the supplies were so-so, but let's just say that when I entered, like they had an x-ray little mm-hmm. spot, right? Mm-hmm. And actually my x-ray tech was an inmate. You see what I mean?
Right.
And then my porters, my helpers were inmates, right?
Right.
And now I did have inmate, no, I had RNs, truly nursing RNs, mm-hmm. but they were married many times to the custody officers, which is a very bad nepotistic relationship in prisons where you have custody married to medical and they want to control the inmates. And then I got thrown into the prison. And, you know, here, this is like the good old boy club. Nevada is really known as the Mississippi of the West. And when I entered, I'm this young, tall, blonde, idealistic doctor, and I have no concept of the fact that I'm rocking the boat on so many levels. And then on top of it, my husband, and we had only been married for a couple of months when I got stuck in the prison, was African-American. And Clifton was this good-looking, tall, black male, platoon leader, Vietnam, had an MBA in finance. And when we moved to Carson City, Nevada, that small capital has maybe 40,000 people. There were absolutely zero black people, zero, in the whole city. And Clifton was the only one. And the first week we were there, he was stopped and asked for his parole papers, you know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I walk into the prison, I realize one out of four of my patient population, the inmates, are African-American. And I thought, where did they all come from? You know, it's like, it was such a shock. You know, you're here, you walk there, and it's like, and they had shipped a lot of those guys up from Las Vegas.
Mm.
Because they didn't have a lot of big prisons in Vegas. The prisons were up near the Capitol because those prisons, one of them was built in 1862 before Nevada was even a state. It was a territorial prison.
Oh, wow.
You see, and then the other prison system was built in the 60s. That's the one I worked at.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, you see, so in the big prisons in Vegas didn't get built until probably the 90s or later.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a unique situation. And
can you elaborate a little bit more about what it was like when you first started? You moved to Carson City, and your husband, he's being stopped randomly. You're at this prison with, you know, 25%, you know, black population. What happened?
Well, what happened was when it was a wild time because 1987 was the height of the HIV epidemic as well.
Okay.
Right. Before they even had drugs, AZT came out in the fall of 1987. So when I started, I was just oriented to give the best care, and I was pushing things the prison had never experienced. And because I cared about the inmates, they looked at me and labeled me as an inmate lover. Okay. You can imagine this, right? Just because I want to give care. Right. So security, custody looked at me as a risk. And then they created investigations on me where they, and it's complicated, but imagine in a prison, if people complain about you, i.e. custody, they put in their paperwork to the inspector general's office. And then the inspector general's office is obligated to basically spy on you and find out whatever they want about you. So then that investigation was going on for months. And it was started by the associate warden at my facility and his wife, who was the nurse, because they controlled that place and looked at me as a risk.
So what were they so concerned about? I mean, you were just treating...
Well, yeah, but they had never had really a real doctor ever treat the inmates. So
they didn't want you to treat the inmates to make them better?
Stand up for them.
Oh.
They don't care. They don't want that. They want to control. right? They want to control. And in their minds, they felt, since she's nice, therefore the inmates are going to get over on her and have her bring in drugs or weapons or who knows what. You know what I mean? That's how they thought.
Right. Okay. I see. Right.
That's how they thought. And the thing is, just because I'm nice doesn't mean I'm stupid. You know, it's like a mother who a kid goes, "Mommy, you're pretty. Can I have the cookie on top of the refrigerator?" You know, I
mean, this is about the answer is like, thank you, but no.
Right. Yeah, right. It's sort of, I mean, you know, this is like human nature. And imagine the prison director at that time, who's head of the entire state. When I heard about all these rumors that I was being investigated, I started getting fearful. I contacted that prison director. And then he said, "Come to my office." And I thought, oh no. I go to his office, and that's in another place. But he, when I walked in, he stuck this whole pack of like papers in front of me, like a big file that was on me. And I had only been there a year.
Oh, wow.
Only been there a year, but they have the thing in the state. If they can get rid of you before the first year, they don't really have to have a good reason. You see what I mean? It's like a probationary period.
Right.
So there's this investigation, and he puts it in front of me and he said, "You know, doctor, I never do this because investigations are supposed to be whatever, you know, confidential. But in this case, I want you to read it because I want you to know your enemies so you can get them before they get you." And I was like, wait a second. This is not my type of world, right? And when
So the prison, the overall prison director was on your side.
He was on my side. Yeah.
Well, that's a blessing.
Yeah, he was on my side. And you know, and he's also stepping out of bounds doing something like that. But for him to say, "I want to know all your enemy, you, I want you to know your enemies so you can get them." I was like, that's not in me. But when I read it, it was really horrible. They took everything out of context and warped it around. They basically stated that they didn't trust me because I was married to a Black man and therefore I would do better things for the Black inmates. You know, I mean,
it was a lot of racism.
It was sexism.
Misogyny.
And also the security mindset that they had never experienced, I think, anybody who had been compassionate. That was like, what is that person doing in a prison? This is crime, pain, punishment, shame. Lock them up, throw away the key. Don't you ever do anything good for them. You know, that type of mindset. Mm-hmm. So that made me an outlier. And the other thing is, when I was hired, they had a medical director, like a guy at the top in charge of all the medicine for the state. Mm-hmm. So when I started in about, I met him once for the interview. The next time I met him was 2 weeks later after I started, and he had come back from a vacation where he had collapsed his spine from metastatic cancer and then boom, was gone. So then I had no one above me in the entire state to one, tell me what to do, to mentor me, to tell me. So I was like thrown into a shark bin with no protection and also no direction. Like nobody knew what to do with HIV in the early days. Nevada was highly weird and unique as a state because it's sort of homophobic. In 1985, when the test came out, they tested every single inmate in the state. So they knew who was positive, but then they didn't think, well, what do we do with that information, right? Mm-hmm. Do we tell the inmate? Do we give education? If there is treatment, what do we do? They didn't know. And I had nobody above me. You see what I mean? So mm-hmm. all of these unique things were given to me. And then I just stepped up because I'm just operating like a doctor. Like, wait a second. If someone's positive, they need to know they're positive. We need to have education so they don't transmit. because custody was so scared. Custody would know someone was positive and then, you know, make their lives miserable. It was a very ugly situation in those days. So I had to deal with that as well.
I have another question. Were there, at that time, were there a lot of trans inmates as well?
No. I had an occasional individual who would, and that's an interesting thing where you have a male come in, and we had one or two that would have had, you know, the breast enlargements to look like a female, but that was very rare in Nevada, very rare. And I remember, like, the first individual I had was actually a big guy. He looked sort of like a Schwarzenegger with Dolly Parton, you know, breasts, which mm-hmm. was sort of bizarre in the prison for me. And the Nevada had the mindset, anyone would be housed based on their plumbing. So if they had a penis, they didn't care if the person mentally was a female or even looked like a female. If they had a penis, they were in a male prison. And I remember this poor guy, well, poor female, but the individual had huge, huge breasts and they needed a bra. I mean, because it was mm-hmm. just, you know, killing them.
Right.
And I ordered some huge bra just so the person wouldn't have such pain. Mm-hmm. And then I was written up for giving sexual underwear to an inmate. Do you see what I mean?
Right. You know? Right.
It's like, oh, God. Right. Stuff like that, you know, sort of they were, because they couldn't understand in their minds. It's like, I don't want a female underwear on a male prison yard. And I'm just like a doctor, like this individual needs support because it's killing them.
Right. Right.
Off their chest there.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, all these
like
things,
a D or a double D or something like that.
Right, yeah. It was extraordinary, the size. I mean, it really, because you could actually see, you know, the stretch marks and the tear going on.
Oh,
it was like
wow.
Way too heavy.
Yeah.
Way too heavy. And then the biggest thing was when that prison director, like the first year, he protected me. And then he left the prison. And about 6 months later, I was taken hostage in the prison. And to this day,
this is like a year and 6 months into
my 4 year term. Yeah. And to this day, I'll always think and believe that there were certain forces that allowed that to happen. You see what I mean?
Right. Right. Right.
Yeah. But I was taken hostage.
Trying to steer you out of there.
Yeah. I was taken hostage, and the inmate, Kenneth Meller, he had been like a Marine vet in Vietnam and had problems. Mm-hmm. And he ended up taking me. He had been a life sentence, you know, life without parole.
Mm-hmm.
And he took me hostage. And then 10 hours, I was assaulted, raped, all sorts of bad things happened to me in those 10 hours. And then they got me out with a SWAT team from another city. And they had to do flashbang grenade, and they assaulted the room, and they blew him away maybe 2 or 3 feet from me and killed him. And then when I got out, the warden at that time, you know, just asked some questions, and I was like in shock. I mean, really. And all what I wanted to do was get out of there as quick as possible. And it happened Friday the 13th in October, 1989. And it's a wild story on top of that. But imagine I get out of there because I don't want to tell them what happened to me. You see what I mean? I'm not ready to talk about it. And even though I was hurt, you know, as a doctor, I'm like, forget it. I'm going to just take care of myself. And on Monday, I'm back at work, and they never called. They never checked. And when I got back to work, no one actually really said anything to me, not custody, not administration. And when I walked back into my exam room, there was still a hole in the wall where they had sledgehammered the thing and put in the grenade. There was still blood gushing up from the tiles. You know, they cleaned up the majority of the mess, but you know, you still see bullet holes, blood coming up from the tiles, the hole in the wall. And when you first come back, I have so much adrenaline and so much shock going on. I'm sort of glad no one's, you know, talking to me. But then you realize, or you think, nobody cares at all that I almost died. And then you, then because I'm paranoid because of being prior investigated, I think, who wants me dead that bad to let this happen to me? And it was the inmates who, when they would see me, they would show their compassion. They're the only ones who really sent get well cards. You see what I mean? I mean, they really showed me they cared. And that was one of the things that helped me heal from that event. Wow. And I think what maybe the prison world didn't understand was that I was raised by a German mother who survived Russian POW camps, the war. She's 91 now. She's tough to kill. You see what I mean?
Right.
And when I grew up, it was always this mindset of, you don't complain, you know, you fall out of a tree and break a leg, just suck it up or something, you know.
Right.
And you never stop working, and you always fight against abusers of power.
Wow.
And so I developed this German stubbornness on top of it, where you want me gone, well, that's the last thing that's going to happen. You know, that was a piece of it as well, your personality wise.
Mm-hmm. So how did that affect your home life, like everything that you went through?
Yeah, well, that was interesting, because my husband is, you know, my husband passed away 2 years ago, but he was really, really like a rock of Gibraltar, but he had been a combat vet. So he suspected what happened to me, but he didn't push it. And it took me probably 2 or 3 weeks before I even told him. And he was one of those, like some people would say to me, oh my goodness, how could your husband let you go back to work? But my husband and I had this sort of mindset of, we didn't tell each other what to do with our lives. See what I mean?
Right.
And he was very supportive. And on top of it, I actually pulled him into the prison, my husband, because I saw how many men were African American, and they didn't have any role models or, you know, really.
Mm-hmm.
And my husband, since he was a combat vet, there was in the system one African American officer who I really liked, Harold Brown. And Harold Brown was one of the first Navy SEALs in the United States. He had been UDT, which is underwater demolitions in Korea. Okay. Then he was sort of grandfathered in as a SEAL in Vietnam.
And
it was really interesting. My husband became friends, you know, right? Uh-huh. Harold, he lived in another city, but he worked in the system. And he and my husband became friends. And Harold said, you know, we have so many vets, combat vets in the prison, and they've approached me to do a sort of veterans group. And we need an outside person to be sort of like the finance person for the group, you know, if we want to raise money or do anything. Mm-hmm. And my husband was on board with that.
Okay.
Because he helped, you know, with the Vietnam Wall, my husband, he was really into that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then because he was into that, the inmates through the grapevine knew I was married to an African American. And then there was a guy on the yard who had been with the NAACP, you know, the inmate NAACP. And he approached me and said, hey, Dr. Gedney, we just got permission to do this whole Martin Luther King Day speech. but our speaker in Reno canceled at the last minute. Can you please, please ask your husband to speak, right? So I went home and I asked Clifton, hey, would you come into the prison in this big gym with, you know, like 1,000 inmates or so, and give a speak for Martin Luther King Day speech? And he was like, why? I'm a finance guy. And I said, no, Cliff, it's because you're Black. This is why you need to come in, right? And I pulled him into that. He gave a great speech. And then the guys asked him, hey, Mr. Macklin, because we have different names, Mr. Macklin, can you teach a Black history course in the college? We want something for us, right? Mm-hmm. And he ended up teaching ethnic history of the United States, because what they didn't know about Cliff is Cliff was what I would tease him. He was a mutt. You know, he was German, Black, and Cherokee, right? So he had a real sense of the discrimination against the Native American Indians as well.
Gotcha.
Right. And he also, since he loved history, he really understood the other ethnic groups like the Italians and the Irish, who were very much put upon when they first came to the United States as well, right? So but he gave that course. And then my husband ended up teaching finance, accounting, HR, and he actually taught at all the major three prisons in the North. He loved to teach. And he loved mentoring the inmate population. Mm-hmm. And he had a lot of white guys as well who adored Clifton. In fact, in my book, I talk about in the first class, there was one of the Aryan warriors, you know, the white supremacist type guy, sitting in the back watching, you know, what was going on in the first class. And then after everybody left, he actually came up to my husband and he said, you know, Mr. Macklin, if I had an uncle or a brother like you, I wouldn't be in the prison for a lifetime. And my 3-year-old son wouldn't be without a father. And I would love it if you could mentor my son. Now that changed my husband's whole mindset, you know, to be asked by a white supremacist really to mentor his 3-year-old son. And my husband ended up, that was one of the nudges for him to enter the Big Brother, Big Sister organization and mentor kids at risk for parents in prison.
Wow.
Yeah, so he did that. But this day, I think that a lot of the relationships or relations that were on my prison yard at that time mm-hmm. dramatically changed because of my husband.
Wow. So explain a little bit about how the relationships change. You know, your husband is involved. The inmates are looking up to him. Did the custody, did they start to see the benefit and influence that you both were having and in the back?
You know, it depended on the prison director. Mm-hmm. Because prison directors in prisons, at least in my state, they had an average lifespan of 2 to 3 years. So you would get one director who was, let's say, more progressive, and they really liked what, let's say, I was doing, my husband was doing. And then you would get the swing to the more, what should I say, fixed mindset security side. Mm-hmm. The one thing I think that helped my husband was because he was military, he was a combat platoon leader. There were a lot of the, let's say, even the good old boy clubs that still valued a military guy. You see what I mean? Because the prison is very much a military structure. Right. And my husband was fortunate in growing up where he had grown up in Hyde Park in Chicago. Okay. And he had grown up, I always teased him, I grew up poor. He grew up with like the silver spoon because his father was a very wealthy real estate guy and his mother was an international pianist who played at Carnegie Hall. You see what I mean? Yeah. He came from a social strata that was so far away from mine. And he didn't have that, what should I say? He always looked at himself as an elite. So anything where someone would give him a hard time, he would consider them the idiot. You see what I mean? He was right. He was never right. a victim. He was never a victim. And he developed some friends in custody who were combat Vietnam vets. And then we talked about it where he said, you know, Karen, war, when you have a brotherhood in war, he goes, it doesn't matter what color your skin is, blood's thicker than water in war.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the, and my husband really got traction when the next prison director was also a combat vet, you know, one of those guys who survived Hamburger Hill in Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
Right. And so that prison director and my husband got along, and that sort of set the custody mindset, like, hey, the prison director is a combat vet. And actually, the warden at that time was a combat vet from Vietnam. And those guys sort of meshed with my husband, and that sort of gave him some traction.
Right, right.
And once you get traction and legitimacy and in some of the custody and the hierarchy feeling, oh, you're a military combat vet. And, you know, my husband was shot through the chest in Vietnam and lost a lung. I mean, he was a Purple Heart, he was a medal winner and all that sort of stuff. That means something to men, you know.
Right, right. Wow.
So he and any, you know, of the smaller guys who were intimidated, my husband was like, doesn't matter. Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. So now, since you've retired from being a prison doctor, you've written your book.
Right.
And, can you tell us about your book and what you're doing now?
Yeah, the big thing is that when I retired from the prison, I still wanted to help the inmates, but I wasn't exactly sure the best way to do it. But one of the things people had told me over the years, because I would tell them some stories once in a while, plus they see it in the papers, and they would say, oh, you got to write a book. And so I kept journals, I kept what inmates wrote, and in the back of my mind, once in a while, I would write a chapter. And then when I left, I decided stories make impact on people. So I'll write a book and I'll start it the day I enter the prison, the day I left, so they could see it, the system through my eyes, not, you know, the inmate side or the custody side, but someone who was naive, like many people are in the outside world. Mm-hmm. And then they can see both sides. And I didn't tell them what to think. I just wanted them to experience everything I did, what I felt and did. And I wanted that to impact the reader so they could see the inmate, not as a group, but as really individuals that maybe they could resonate with.
Mm-hmm.
And that they would be oriented to become more aware of what was going on in prisons and with incarceration and how disproportionately the mentally ill, the poor, the minority populations basically get screwed,
right?
You know, in the criminal justice. I wanted them to see that and understand that. And also the dilemma of inside a prison when the public is not aware of what's really going on, how that can be very dangerous. And also depending on who is in charge at a director level, how you can get programs that are progressive or things that just stultify people and right. mess them up.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to show.
Yeah, I think a lot of people think that, you know, the prisons really aren't, they don't rehabilitate anyone.
Yes.
And I would guess that, you know, the people who have a very, you know, fixed custody mindset, you know, running the prisons, there's no rehabilitation going on.
No, that's they look at it very much like my job is to incarcerate and make sure they don't escape. End of story. And that when they leave, not my problem. And my message is very much holistic prison reform, where tactics don't work. It's strategy. And you have to have a strategy that prevents individuals from entering it in the first place. If they do enter it, you actually heal and make them less risk than when they leave. And then when they do leave, that you support their reentry. It has to be a whole picture. When people try to do one little tactic, that's fine. But if one of those three things aren't working, the system's not going to change. Right. It really has to be a holistic approach.
So my final question to you is, what do you see as the way to move forward for the prisons to be more effective and more habilitative? Because I believe it's in the public's best interest for the recidivism rate to be reduced.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And to me, the largest thing is being aware of those three key points and then having society, let's say, motivated to affect those three things. And the thing is, when I really was on this mission since the 80s, that wasn't even talked about. Now you see prison reform really being talked about. So instead of just talking about it, there are different organizations and different people really pushing those buttons. But all those three big categories have to be pushed together. You see now less people going into the prisons right now because they're trying to restructure bail and violation and changing laws to affect mandatory minimums, affecting juvenile systems. So you see this happening, but it has to be continued. And we really also have to look at other countries who are doing it so much better. You know, as an example, Germany. I like to tell people, hey, you look at Germany as an industrialized country, and you know, did you know that they have 10% of the prison population per capita than we do? Just 10%. And that they have half as much violent crimes. Now, to me, if you look at that, you think, okay, now what are they doing so different, right, as a culture? Mm-hmm. And it's not just the prisons, it's their culture. They have larger support nets than this country does. Right. People who are mentally ill or having problems, there's a net for them. In the United States, there's just huge holes that people drop through and then end up doing things that end up in the system.
Yeah, I think the social safety net is definitely one that needs to be enlarged. And these big corporations who are, you know, really putting the squeeze on people should pay.
I agree. And also the laws have to really be changed because, you know, in Nevada, for example, and this is just an example where in Nevada, there's legislation up where if you have traffic violations and you don't pay them, well, then you have fines, then you have court fines, then you have warrants, and basically you're criminalizing not being able to pay your fines because you're poor. And in fact, Harvard did a big study on Clark County down in Las Vegas, and they pointed out that when you look at the cops stopping people, you know, 70% of the people they were really stopping were the minority population. Right. And then that population who's driving without a registered tag or this and that, then they get fines, then they get court fees, then they get warrants, and then they're in jail. And that those type of people should not be. And then they plead, then they get the criminal record, and all of this sort of spins them off into getting thrown into a prison down the road.
Yeah, it's horrible. It really is horrible. And so many factors, you know, create this negative synergy. So I want you to, you know, tell people, how can they connect with you to learn more, to be a part of the change, advocating for change in the prison system, and how can they read your book? I'm definitely going to get your book. Read it.
Yeah. Fascinating. Yeah. And I'll send you a copy, Z, if you give me your address.
Okay. A signed copy?
Yeah, a signed copy. Of course.
Oh, okay. I would love that. Thank you so much.
And in the book, whoever gets the book, they'll see also artwork from one of the inmates that starts each chapter, because I want to support, you know, my inmates who are in the outside world. But for your people who listen, if they're interested, they definitely should check out my book and get it on Amazon. And they can also go to my website, which is discoverdrg.com. So it's discoverdrgedney.com. And then what I would recommend is, after they read the book and they're actually interested in getting involved in prison reform or trying to be helpful, a lot of people will say, wow, you know, what can one person do? And I'll say something on the order of, first, you want to think about mentoring first a kid at risk, because if we can break the school to prison pipeline, that would be wonderful. And the other thing is, if they're politically interested in legislation, there are definitely groups like the ACLU or other groups in states that will point out legislation that needs to be changed. And I got your address, Z, so you'll definitely get a book. And there are also some people who are sort of fascinated by prisons, and some people don't know they can actually volunteer in many prisons, whether it's through religious groups or sometimes other programs. Some prisons will have entrepreneurial programs. Mm-hmm. If you're an employer, you want to take a look at hiring an ex-felon. Certain states have these ex-felons that come out and are bonded. There are tax opportunity credits for companies. There are different reasons why to give someone who's had a prior incarceration record a second chance. Because if you vet them correctly, they can be your most loyal employee because you gave them a second chance. And if they're interested in podcasts, just to get a sense of all the different things going on, I think one of the best ones I personally like is something called Decarceration Nation. And they're one of the last episodes I listened to, they had Van Jones, you know, on it, who is also very much into prison reform.
Right.
And he's been working with, you know,
Kardashian, getting her, she's working on becoming an attorney, and she's also been working on prison reform as well.
Right. Yeah. So they're different organizations that they can look into. But the biggest thing, I think, is first to become interested. In my book, I think, gives a person a sense of why in retirement, you know, I've chosen to take this on, mm-hmm. to be an advocate for prison reform. And in my state right now, they're trying to abolish the death penalty, you know, so I've written newspaper articles and I'm trying to throw my voice as a prison doctor, because in 1989, I was asked to write for the drugs for execution, right? Mm-hmm. You know, because it was my job. And I refused.
Right.
And in just about the death penalty in general, the more people understand how unjust and least cost effective, and it doesn't deter crime and innocent people are on death row. There's so many reasons why this country should abolish the death penalty across the road, well, you know, across all states.
The biggest reason is because the justice system is so flawed, and
yes,
people get whether it's, you know, criminal or civil or even business, there's always these lawsuits that are frivolous, these actions that are wrong, people who lie under oath. It's just too many things that aren't fair in the process.
Yeah. In fact, they did a study like in Las Vegas and Clark County, where they looked at the men on death row. And what they found is that of the death row cases, 47% of the cases in Clark County, where you have the large population of African Americans, 47% had prosecutorial misconduct. Well, so imagine that. I mean, these are death row cases.
And you can't have that. And this is a person's life.
Right, right. And the thing is, in the death row, some people think it deters crime, but all the studies show, no, it doesn't deter crime, because people who do violent acts, emotional, illogical, mentally ill acts, or just they got some loose wires up there.
Right. They're not thinking about logic
and deterrence. You know, that's just not what happens.
You know, I've been watching on Netflix. They have a lot of different docuseries and different things about people on death row, people who've committed crimes. And one thing that I was struck by is how many of them really didn't have stable home lives. They didn't have romantic relationships, familial relationships, parental relationships. They're, you know, people who feel, you know, isolated, forgotten, and, you know, for whatever reason, they just, you know, got caught in a really bad situation. Like there was one guy who basically blacked out and killed his family, who he loved. And it's like he had no coping skills. They didn't know how to, you know, manage his anger. He didn't know how to breathe and take a time out. I mean, it's just all these things that you know to do, I know to do,
my son is being raised to do.
But there are people who don't have that that social norming, that support to understand how you deal with certain things, these soft skills, these soft coping skills. And, you know, I'm with you. I think death row is really, it's sad. You know,
and, you know, we're really the only industrialized country out there that actually has the death penalty. And supposedly we are the, you know, land of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But there's so much that the United States has that it's hard to wrap your mind around the injustice and the racism. And the unfairness of what happens with people. Mm-hmm. You know, they want it both ways, but they have to be honest when they look at the whole picture that our system is highly flawed. And, right. You know, it's taken, most people don't even realize that, you know, if you look at incarceration rates in the late 70s, we were like the rest of the world, late 70s, rest of the world. And then from the late 70s up until 2000, we literally quadrupled and quintupled, you know, quintupled our incarceration rate per capita. No other country did that.
I think the reason why is because during that time frame, you had the war on drugs.
That's right. That was the biggest thing. But also you had mandatory minimums.
And the three-strike law.
You know, and three laws, you know, three strikes and you're out, and all these really heavy-handed things. And then even the thought of giving, you know, a life sentence to a juvenile exists. I mean, it's crazy. No other country does that.
Yeah. And then you have the stories of, I think it's called the Central Park Five.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Know, all these stories and these confessions that are made under duress.
Right.
I mean, it's so much that goes on that needs to stop. And so I definitely applaud you for, in spite of everything you've went through. Wow. Yeah. to still, you know, have compassion and empathy and being able to stand. So please go to Dr. Getney's website. It is discoverdrg.com. You can read about her book, learn how you can get involved, and also learn how you can also volunteer in the prisons. I think this is definitely something that, you know, as an entrepreneur, as a professional, you all should consider giving an inmate a second chance by getting them a job.
Yes.
Jobs make peace.
Right.
So thank you so much, Dr. Getney, for being on the podcast. And until next time.
Yeah. And Z, this was wonderful talking to you, and you'll definitely get my autograph book, and hopefully you'll tell others about it. And I think you'll like the artwork too.
All right. Thank you so much. And I'm looking forward to reading your book.
Okay, Z.
The SEO queen, more credibility. The SEO queen, more visibility. The SEO queen, more profitability. The SEO queen, the SEO queen, the SEO queen, the SEO queen, the SEO queen. More credibility, more visibility, more profitability. The SEO queen.
Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Stan, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.